With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City Newsday. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Wednesday, August the 2nd. Coming up in today's show, the head of the EPA is meeting with farmers across the country to talk about WOTUS. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But first, here's Brian German.
The plans for the Temperance Flat Dam and Reservoir Project are due to be submitted by August 14th, but there's still a lengthy process before a decision is made. Executive Director for the San Joaquin Valley Water Infrastructure Authority, Mario Santoyo, noted they aren't expecting any kind of decision for quite some time.
Some initial determinations will be made in January of 2018, but the final determinations won't really occur until June of 2018. So we're looking at about a one-year period between now and then for this whole process to play out.
There are multiple projects applying for the available funding, but supporters of Temperance Flat are optimistic about their chances of being approved based on the multiple benefits the project could provide to Central Valley communities.
It's water for people to drink because it provides water for cities. It provides water to grow food. And those are the two things that human beings need.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West.
Members of the House Ag Committee held a Farm Bill listening session in San Angelo, Texas this week. The session lasted for more than 3 hours, during which time the panel heard from representatives from several areas of agriculture. Texas Farm Bureau President Russell Boning was the first to speak.
Since the 2014 Farm Bill, we all know net farm income has dropped dramatically, almost 50%. At that time, agriculture contributed $23 billion in deficit reduction in the 14 Farm Bill. Due to the fact that the economy in the farm sector has dropped dramatically, we believe we need a strong safety net to keep going forward to have a strong agriculture. We support the continuation of PLC and the ARC programs. We know the ARC program had some issues between counties. We think the ARC County program should be looked at. We stress the importance of cotton. Being out here, I know everybody saw a lot of cotton this morning. And it's very important to this part of the state and to all of this state. We think cotton needs to go back in the Title I of the farm program. Dairy margin protection program hasn't worked for our dairy producers. It definitely needs to be looked at. We need a stronger program there. Crop insurance. Crop insurance is so vital to this state, so vital to every crop in this state, whether it be corn, wheat, cotton, all of the crops come very much into play when it comes to crop insurance. Talk a little bit about livestock. The livestock disaster program needs to be improved, and possibly some new programs need to be looked at for the livestock industry. Something that's happening in South Texas, and many of y'all have heard about it, talking about the fever tick. We have a task force with Farm Bureau actually working on some issues, working on some solutions, we hope. We hope to make that maybe part of the Farm Bill discussion. So that we can work on that devastating pest. Conservation, we support the EQIP program, Conservation Stewardship Program. We think those programs are good. Rural development and maintaining current funding levels there are very important. That's kind of the facts and figures. I want to say just a little bit about what I call the big picture. When we start talking about net farm income down 50%, we're talking about affecting real farmers and ranchers. A lot of times young farmers and ranchers, affecting rural communities, as y'all well know. Driving in yesterday, I drove through a lot of rural communities. I live right south of San Antonio. And coming into Wall, Texas, that community is very dependent on agriculture. So when we talk about supporting agriculture, we're not talking about just farmers. We're talking about the rural communities. We're talking about the national economy, farm receipts. Contribute about $1 billion when you talk about the whole food industry to our GDP. So with all that in mind, we believe that a strong farm economy is vital to not only rural communities, but the entire national economy. I want to thank the committee for your time. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
A Farm Bill listening session is scheduled for this Saturday in Modesto. AgNet West will be live streaming the session on our website. Head to agnetwest.com for more information. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has spent much of July and will continue in August traveling across America to talk with farmers, ranchers, and landowners. Pruitt is meeting with farmers across the country to talk about the 2015 Waters of the U.S. rule that he's rolling back and what a new and improved WOTUS rule should have. Pruitt says the listening tour is helping him get input for the new rule, which could be released as early as this September.
You know, this kind of discussion is so helpful to us because as we go across states, across the country, we get a chance to hear issues that are particular to Oklahoma, Utah, Minnesota, and hear it from folks who live these kinds of issues every day. So our goal and our objective and our responsibility is to make sure that as we develop a new definition of what a water in the United States is, that it provides objective criteria that farmers and ranchers in Oklahoma know where federal jurisdiction begins and ends. That didn't happen in 2015. It will happen with the new rule, and we're going to respect private property rights. We know that farmers and ranchers are the first environmentalists, and they care about their land, and they're going to be partners in this process, not adversaries.
Pruitt says he's hearing a lot of farmers asking him for regulatory certainty. He explains what that means.
When we talk about regulatory certainty, we want folks knowing whether rules apply to them or not so that they know how to appropriate the issues and allocate resources to comply and to do what's necessary. I mean, a dry creek bed in southwest Oklahoma, a drainage ditch in northeast Oklahoma, or a puddle, you know, as I was in Utah last week, I was looking at an ephemeral drainage ditch outside of a subdivision, and that was called a water in the United States under the previous rule. That provides great uncertainty, because that shouldn't be. That's inconsistent with the statute. So we want to make sure that statute and the regulations match, that we have, you know, objective criteria as we engage in rulemaking so that people know what's expected of them, and then they can plan and allocate resources accordingly.
You know, a lot of people in this audience today, and you say farmers and ranchers are the first environmentalists. I think they appreciate you being here.
Well, look, I mean, the land is their greatest asset. And what's crazy to me is, you know, Washington, D.C., and those that form these decisions at times, they don't respect, understand, acknowledge that these folks are partners. They are conservationists. They are environmentalists. They care about their land. They care about the water they drink and the air that they breathe. And we can work together to achieve good outcomes. They should not be put in a position of adversity, of uncertainty. We have to work together, and that's not happened the last several years, and it's changing dramatically as we go forward.
Pruitt is also saying that the rule he hopes to propose to replace the 2015 WOTUS rule will have durability.
Well, it's not just getting the definition right initially. It's getting it right so that it is durable and that folks can have a longer expectation and it won't be displaced 2 years from now. I mean, it's not a good situation for regulations to change every 2 or 3 or 4 years. And so if you get a definition right, it's within the statute, the courts come in and affirm it. That gives confidence to people that they can start making decisions on how to use their land, that they're not going to be hit with a fine or penalty because they didn't seek an EPA permit. We want durability, longevity in these definitions so that it applies over the long haul as opposed to these, you know, short spurts of well, it doesn't apply today and tomorrow it may. So we are seeking to achieve that. I believe we will achieve that. And that provides not only certainty in the near term, but certainty in the long term.
He will continue his listening tour this month. The public comment period for the proposed rule to rescind the 2015 WOTUS rule runs through August 28th. Pruitt hopes to release the draft language on a new and improved WOTUS as early as September. He has hopes of finalizing the new and improved WOTUS by early 2018. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and that the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by Agnet West. And now for the Naval Orange Worm Degree Day report for pistachios, sponsored by Dow AgriSciences and Intrepid Edge Insecticide. Degree days are determined using the calculator at the UCIPM website. All locations use CMIS weather stations. As of July 30th, the degree day total for Dener was 2,054. That's up 160 from the last 7 days. For Merced, 2,013. That's up 154 in the last week. For Firebaugh, 2,279. That's up 176. For Pinoche, 2,004. That's up 152. Tranquility, 2,485. That's up 187 in the last week. Parlier, 2,459. That's up 184. Degree days for 5 points, 2,621. That's up 174. For Coalinga, 2,510. That's up 202. Stratford, 2,459. That's up 188 in the last week. Degree days for Delano, 2,375. That's up 185. Blackwell's Corner, 2,373. That's up 199 in the last 7 days. Lost Hills, 2,601. That's up 189. Shafter, 2,447. That's up 184. And for Arvin, degree days, 2,697. That's up 209 in the last week. NOW Degree Day reports are sponsored by Dow AgriSciences and Intrepid Edge Insecticide. This report, as well as past reports, can also be found on our website, agnetwest.com.
Well, in today's livestock news, late last week, Japan announced their safeguard tariff on frozen U.S. beef, increasing the tariff from 38.5% to 50%. The new rate began August 1st and will last through March 31st of 2018. The U.S. beef industry says had the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement been in effect, or if the U.S. had a bilateral trade deal with Japan, the tariff increase could have been avoided. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Phil Tsang says first quarter U.S. sales triggered the tariff.
The safeguard that they had in TPP was on a yearly basis, and it was much more liberal. So I have the feeling because we just exceeded the amount by only 113 metric tons, it was very, very close under this old administration, but definitely under TPP, but this would not have been the case.
Now, Japan is the U.S.'s largest beef market, worth $1.5 billion, close to half of that being frozen product. Thus, Tsang says the WTO-permitted 11.5% tariff hike could have a big impact on our frozen beef sales.
This is going to impact the food service market, especially in Japan. They have certain items in their cuisine, which they call the beef bowl, where they have beef on top of rice. This is primarily our frozen short plates, and that's 90% of our frozen inventory. And so that's going to have an impact pretty much immediately. There's some inventory in Japan, but if it goes on for, let's say, a month or two, there's going to be more pronounced impact.
And Australia frozen beef now has a nearly 23% tariff advantage over U.S. beef, while Mexico has a similar deal. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue has asked Japanese officials to address the concerns, but Tsang says a decision to suspend the automatic tariff would have to come from Japan's legislature. Well, U.S. poultry producers say the modernization of the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, could bring trade improvements. The National Chicken Council and the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council together called NAFTA a bonanza for American agriculture. But the group says some trade issues could be improved under the renegotiation effort. The National Chicken Council says Canada and the U.S. had reached preliminary agreement on increasing the quotas for U.S. chicken into Canada, which could be included in NAFTA. The U.S. industry also believes that there should be similar increases in the market access for U.S. turkey and turkey products. The poultry industry also stands by sanitary and phytosanitary rules that were negotiated as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and urged the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to adopt the improved rules as part of the NAFTA renegotiation. Mexico is the largest export market for the U.S. poultry industry. Canada is the second largest export market. And South Korea last week requested the Trump administration to postpone any review of the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement until a new trade minister is appointed in South Korea. The request comes after U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer requested a review of the agreement on July 12th in a letter to Korea's former Minister of Trade. South Korea suggested that both sides objectively examine, analyze, and assess the effects of the agreement before the meeting takes place. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
Soybeans, one of our three largest crops. It's also one of the most widely grown crops. Midwest, Southwest, Southeast. It's a crop with a lot of possibilities, but it has not reached its potential. Every farmer who grows soybeans will see 100 bushels per acre. I don't know what the national average is, but it's substantially lower than that. Some individual farmers have produced 100 bushels per acre, but mostly on small, experimental plots. They can't do it on their entire crop. Well, researchers say it will happen, but they won't speculate on time. It's pretty well accepted that the answer will not be more plants per acre, nor fertilizer and labor, but a plant that produces more pods and pods that produce more beans. Well, that's simple enough. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Griner, AgNet West.
More than 140 witnesses provided feedback to the Environmental Protection Agency Tuesday on the agency's recent proposed volume obligations under the Renewable Fuel Standard, with the majority supporting renewable fuels. Renewable Fuels Association President and CEO Bob Dineen thanked EPA for proposing to maintain the 15 billion gallon requirement for conventional renewable fuels in its 2018 Renewable Fuel Standard rule, but urged the agency to increase its proposed cellulosics ethanol requirement to reflect the growing bolt-on technologies at existing ethanol plants. We have for you now remarks from Bob Dineen.
Good morning, I'm Bob Dineen, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. On behalf of our members, I'd like to thank EPA for maintaining the 15 billion gallon requirement for undifferentiated biofuels, the bucket in which corn ethanol competes. We believe EPA is well justified in that decision, given the overwhelming evidence that more than sufficient D6 RINs will be available for compliance this year and next. The U.S. ethanol industry is currently producing at a rate of 15.7 billion gallons on an annualized basis, and there is a RIN surplus of greater than 2 billion RINs. Supply, the only thing the court now agrees you can look at, is not a problem. We understand the agency's dilemma in establishing an appropriate RVO for cellulosic ethanol, but we truly believe the agency has erred on the side of pessimism with regard to the potential for significant growth in cellulosic ethanol. We know of many plants that are in the process of adding bolt-on fiber conversion technology that will dramatically increase cellulosic ethanol production next year, and we intend to provide you with updated projections during the comment period. The NPRM announced EPA will initiate a separate reset rule. We respect the agency's obligation to reset the advanced and cellulosic biofuel targets to provide greater long-term stability in those markets, but we caution the agency that reset does not mean repeal. And the agency must be faithful to the spirit and intent of the RFS, including maximizing the nation's use of these fuels, driving marketplace innovation and investment in these new technologies, and making the U.S. more energy diverse while lowering carbon. Congress entrusted EPA with the authority to reset the RFS, not to gut the RFS. The agency has asked for comment on the RIN markets. We'll provide further detail in our written comments, but the RFA remains concerned that RIN market manipulation, not market forces, is a significant factor driving RIN prices today. We agree with one independent refiner who just last week said, quote, "The continued volatility and extraordinarily high prices of RINs further proves that we are dealing with a manipulated and contrived market. RINs were intended to be a compliance mechanism, not a contrived trading platform," unquote. EPA must end RIN price manipulation. The agency suggests that imported biofuels are undermining the efficacy of the RFS. We disagree, and we are hopeful the agency does not contemplate a non-tariff barrier to trade through this program that would run afoul of existing international trade agreements and trigger a response that could impede the success of U.S. biofuel exports. The RFS is not the platform to address trade concerns. In my close, I was going to say something about how wonderful it is that EPA staff is here and taking comments all day, but alas, I am out of time.
Once again, Renewable Fuels Association President and CEO Bob Dineen.
I'm speaking with Donnell Rehagen, who is Chief Executive Officer for the National Biodiesel Board, and he just testified At a hearing by the Environmental Protection Agency on the renewable fuel standard about the volume obligations that were proposed by EPA for biodiesel in the coming years. And Donnell, why don't you just tell me about what the National Biodiesel Board, its comments are to EPA regarding their proposal.
Yeah, so Cindy, the EPA is proposing volumes for 2018 and 2019 for advanced biofuels and biomass-based diesel. That's our sweet spot. So we are here in D.C. to talk to the EPA about what they're proposing, the proposal they did put out a couple of weeks ago that they're accepting comments on today is, unfortunately, we're not seeing the growth in those numbers that we would like to see. The RFS is specifically built around higher volumes of advanced biofuels. The EPA is proposing to actually keep those numbers flat, or in the case of advanced biofuels, even to reduce them slightly in the outcoming years.
The National Biodiesel Board and biodiesel representatives were really out in force at this hearing. It wasn't just you. You testified, but a number of your staff also, and as well as a number of people in the industry. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. We have over 30 of our members and staff and contractors here who have a lot of information and knowledge to share with the EPA to help them come to better conclusions about what our industry can do for advanced biofuels in the out years. So we're excited to share that information today with the EPA.
Well, now on Friday, we had a decision regarding the renewable fuel standard, and I wanted you to explain that a little bit for me.
Yeah, a couple of the big things, and we're still getting through all of that. As you can imagine, with the EPA hearing today, we've kind of been burning the candle at both ends. But the one main issue that we're found in favor of is the inadequate domestic supply argument. Now, this is an argument the EPA was making in order to enact their and use their waiver authority to reduce volumes of advanced biofuels. So they were simply arguing that there's not enough biofuels in the marketplace, so we should make the number lower. And you can kind of have a hard time seeing the logic in that. And that was our argument as well. You can't look at domestic supply. There's a lot of factors that that play into that. We have tons of production capacity to produce higher volumes, but the EPA was arguing because not enough gallons were making its way to the marketplace, they would further reduce those numbers. So we did win on that ruling. And also the obligated parties were arguing that the bio on our specific biomass-based diesel volumes, that because the EPA had missed some statutory deadlines, that the whole the waiver should be enacted there as well and allow that those volumes to be reduced further as well. And the court found in our favor that that was not the case.
So overall, how do you feel right now as far as biodiesel's share of the market, how that might work out going forward?
Yeah, you know, the biodiesel has been kind of the shining star of the RFS. It is the single largest volume of advanced biofuel, and the RFS was built around that principle of bringing more advanced biofuels to the marketplace. In fact, 21 billion gallons of advanced biofuel by 2022. So we are, biodiesel and renewable diesel are the kind of the golden children of that RFS. And so we want to make sure that that is known and that's seen, and that they also understand we have the ability to do even more. So to me, you know, the future, the sky is it's unlimited what we can do. And that's the message that we wanted to deliver to the EPA today. And our members did a nice job of stepping up and delivering that message.
And thank you very much, Donnell Rehagen, CEO of the National Biodiesel Board. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers. But these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the Silage Zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
What's happening below the surface can mean success or failure for your crops. New MycoApply Endomax from Valent USA Corporation is the latest innovation to help take your tree nut, tree fruit, vine, and vegetable crops to the next level. MycoApply Endomax contains a unique blend of four mycorrhizal fungi that colonizes a plant's roots to create a symbiotic root and mycelial network. Where water is limited, this enhanced network improves plant vigor by expanding the root's ability to efficiently absorb water and nutrients under variable environmental conditions. Ultimately, MycoApply Endomax helps deliver consistent plant health and overall performance to optimize yield. Plus, MycoApply Endomax is OMRI listed for organic production. Maximize your crop's potential with new MycoApply Endomax from Valent. For more information, contact your PCA or visit valent.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Healthy soil can help protect your farm from drought and protect soil and water resources. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Wrapping up your agriculture news for today, here's Taylor Hillman.
AgNet West told you about Minturn Hauling Cooperative in LeGrand and how they worked on the air curtain burner with Western Agricultural Processors Association to find an option for the piles of ag waste accumulating on their facility. WAPA President and CEO Roger Isom said this is almost a three-year problem, and there's been little done to help the agriculture industry out.
We started losing biomass plants 2 to 3 years ago, and it's not getting better. There was legislation that was passed this last year that was supposed to help, and it did some plants. But in the final analysis, it now requires 80% forestry waste. And so from an ag perspective, that put a further crimp on people taking ag waste.
Isom said they encourage growers to chip the waste and incorporate it into the land. However, that isn't an option for some, and it's definitely not one for the state's haulers.
If you can chip it and incorporate it back in the soil, great. But like haulers, we have nowhere to put it. It has to go back to the growers, or we have to get rid of it somehow. So you think of every hauler in the state, the inability to get rid of this, to chip it and send it back to the biomass plant. So it's a huge issue. And on the farm side, it's the same problem. Again, if you can incorporate it, great. If you can't, you're stuck with it. There is nowhere for it to go.
To see a video of the air curtain burner, you can head to our website at agnetwest.com. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
With all the sights and sounds of the Crescent City.
Mardi Gras Mambo. Not in New Orleans,
Bourbon Street beats.
Oh,
when the saints
go marching in,
marching in,
boom, 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 boom,
how, 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 how.
Perhaps the most memorable part of any visit to New Orleans, and Louisiana Bayou country for that matter, is the food. Cajun and Creole, etouffee, and po' boys.
Jumbo line, a crawfish pie, and a filet gumbo.
Old Hank's got that right, with many of these delectable dishes, including crawfish.
Mostly what we do around here is we'll sell our crawfish either live or we'll get them. We'll sell them as boiled. Pretty much you could find them on roadside stands and little drive-by restaurants.
Guy Patoot is a commercial crawfish producer in the Bayou State. This industry began in the 1880s with the catch coming out of the swamps and bayous, particularly from the Atchafalaya Basin. And while that practice is still thriving, especially during the summer months, Patoot is one of over 1,600 crawfish farmers who use man-made ponds to produce their commodity.
We typically plant rice in about the month of August, and we start to flood our crawfish ponds. We flood our fields around September So usually we have crawfish around October and November.
Rice provides some of the diet for crawfish, along with insects and fish, during the pond season, which runs from October to well into May or June.
Then the ponds usually shut down, and the Atchafalaya Basin is usually where you get your crawfish after that. Just because the ponds are harder to maintain, they're harder to keep up with the rise in temperatures of the water.
When Patut is not running his crawfish farm, he works as a conservation technician for USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. And he adds both jobs have carryover in terms of skills and practices.
Being a conservationist and for crawfish is pretty important because you have to maintain your water quality, you have to maintain your soil quality, you have to maintain food for the crawfish to eat all year long.
Man-made ponds, like Guy Patut's, became a staple of the Louisiana crawfish industry 50-plus years ago. This practice, along with crawfish farming in the swamps and bayous, has resulted in crawfish becoming the largest freshwater crustacean aquaculture industry in the country, with Louisiana alone producing 90% of the nation's commercial crawfish crop. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.